Execution Watch and KPFT are member-sponsored. The money that makes Execution Watch possible comes from listeners like you. If you care about what you hear, please support KPFT and Execution Watch by going to kpft.org and making a donation. It's tax-deductible, and every bit counts. Thank you.
Arturo Diaz is a prisoner. If Texas has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where Texas is preparing to put Diaz to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions in the modern era. Execution Watch host Ray Hill with legal analyst Jim Skelton, along with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubeck, Houston visual reporter Dave Atwood, and special feature guest Joe Flores, a criminal defense attorney from Corpus Christi, Texas. The Execution Watch for Arturo Diaz begins.
And good evening, this is Ray Hill. I am the host of Execution Watch here on KPFT, 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. We're also on kpft.org on the internet. You can listen to this show on kpftx.org, and you can listen to this show on executionwatch.org. Last week, we had the largest audience that we have ever had for Execution Watch as Robert Garza was executed. So I thought I'd tell the new folks that haven't been listening to us something of what we do and how we do it. This program is produced because it needs to be produced. We do this show because as Texas executes something, we try to hold a light on that execution. Try and listen to the show, keeping in mind that executing people is not about those people and what they may have or may not have done. Executing people is about us and what we do. That is the mental attitude that we approach this show. The members of the staff here at KPFT, for various reasons and from various experiences, are opposed to execution. But we think you need to experience, and as close to real time as possible, what is being done in your name. And we hope that that will motivate you to be politically involved in the issue of criminal justice reform, especially the abolition of executions. I believe Gloria is on the line.
Yes.
Gloria?
The most awful day of their life when they're losing a loved one to the state of Texas.
Gloria is actually on the megaphone. Gloria, are you back?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No,
hi.
That was wonderful. Thank you very much for that. It's a little glimpse into what the reality is in Huntsville. Could you tell us what's going on?
Oh, well, Arturo's grandmother, mother, an older sister, and two friends of his just walked into the death house. We got word from the attorney at 5:45 that the Supreme Court had denied everything. So the killing is going to begin in Texas. Another execution, another week. But standing outside here with us is his daughter, his grandkids, his brothers, his sisters, cousins. They have a large family, and aside from the ones that are witnessing that who are with us, and then we've got a large group of abolitionists here from all over, Germany, France, Houston, Spring, Huntsville, from the Shape Center, from the abolition movement. Boy, they sure got things ready when they only had 15 minutes notice.
Well, Gloria, could you tell us about the abolition movement, the organization,
sure,
and something? We got a... Last week, we had the largest audience we've ever had on the internet, And all week, people have been joining the Facebook page and going to the website and listening to last week's execution. So I suspect we have an inordinately large number of people out there today, and a lot of them are new listeners.
Probably so. I know the Abolition Movement's Facebook page got over 100 new listeners just because of Bobby Garza.
Okay, so tell us about the Abolition Movement, who you are, where you meet, and when's the next meeting?
We're a very active group of death penalty abolitionists. We don't have money, but we've got a lot of determination, and we stay very active. We meet at the Shape Community Center on the corner of Alabama and Live Oak in Houston on the first Tuesday of every month, regardless. And we have for the last, 15, 20 years, I guess. We're on the Facebook at Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, and our website is abolitionmovement.org. We brought a couple of carloads of people up here today, including some of Bobby Garza's friends. Arturo, we found out this afternoon, not only did he get to talk to his large family, but he also talked to Maria, a friend in Germany, and to an elderly woman who was a friend of his who lives in France. Both of them got to call him while he was sitting in the death house here. So, again, a healthy man is being executed, a man that has a loving family, who has friends all over the world. And his family right now is consoling each other as the execution is proceeding.
Well, thank you very much, Gloria. Now, that website is www.abolitionmovement.org.
I'm not even sure if it's www. It might be HTTP. But if you just put abolitionmovement.org, and we will be at the Shape Center on Alameda this Saturday from 8 to 1. There's the Sisters of Shape are having a garage sale, and we've got tons of stuff, and we're raising money for our bus for the annual march, which is going to be Saturday, November 2nd.
All right.
So come by Shape, or bring us a bookcase or a filing cabinet or some.
You'll be glad to get rid of it for a good purpose.
Right.
Thank you, Gloria.
Okay. All right.
Bye-bye. And I believe we have another call. Dave?
Yes.
You are there. Where is there?
Well, we're out by St. Stephen's Church at the corner of Woodhead and West Alabama.
Well, it was awfully good to see you today under more pleasant circumstances than talking to you tonight.
Right, right.
Dave Atwood is the founder and organizer in the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And how many folks you got with you tonight, Dave?
Well, we got 12 people. Good group of people, new people, some new people, some people even that came to the program at noon today, came over here afterwards, and so it's a good mix of people, and I mean, if you can get, my feeling is, if we can get 12 people out on an execution like this one, you know, that hasn't been very well publicized, that's pretty darn good, and we've got our banners, our signs. We've got people, you know, like I said before, most people when they go by, if they're going to do anything, they're giving us a thumbs up or tooting their horn. So it's really good to have this visibility here. I really believe that now, it makes a difference to a lot of people.
Today's lunch gathering is going to be a continuing aspect of the coalition, isn't it?
Right. The next one's going to be on November 12th, I think it was. And I think Kristen Halle is going to come down and give an overview of the strategic plan that the board has developed. And that's going to be, I think it's going to be at the same place every time, in St. Anne's Church, a corner of Westheimer and Shepherd at 12:30. That's the one today was at 12:30. I think that's what they're going to try to replicate each time.
Okay. And it's Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and the website is the acronym of that. That's www.tcadp.org.
That's correct, Ray.
Thank you, Dave. Give our regards to the Vigilance.
I will. Thank you for calling.
Okay, thank
Bye-bye.
You. And that's Dave Atwood and the report from Huntsville. When Gloria says the witnesses have crossed the road, what that means is that the witnesses have gone from the old administration building across 13th Street there, across 13th Street, that sounds ominous just in itself,
right,
into the walls itself, which is where the death chamber is. And that means the process has begun. I think that Arturo Diaz will probably be dead in 20 minutes. Jim, what happened in this case?
The case involves a couple of men. Remember the name of Marshall Nichols, I'm sorry, a guy named John Shepherd. Both of them were living down in McAllen, the Lower Rio Grande Valley, and they were working for Nichols' father. And they were living in an apartment that was owned by the company. And the way they met Arturo Diaz and a guy by the name of Jose Cordova is through a stripper. There was a stripper in the valley named Danielle Thomas. And what was unusual about it, she didn't work in the club. She worked private parties. And apparently she was hanging around with Nichols quite a bit. And apparently Arturo Diaz was hanging around with what they call a bodyguard for the stripper. Because when she'd go do private parties, she had to have security. And so Diaz apparently had some relationship with the bodyguard and Thompson. And Nichols had some relationship with Thompson. Nonetheless, here's what happened. A couple of days before the murder occurred, Nichols and Thompson went out partying, and surprisingly, he said his debit card was eaten by a debit machine, couldn't get any money, and the stripper loaned him $100, and they went partying. That night, they ended up back at the apartment, and at the apartment, of course, Jose Diaz was there, as well as Jose Cordova. They're all there, and they all kind of partied together. And the next day, what happened, stripper goes home, takes care of her business, and she came back the next day to get her $100 that was owed to her by Michael Nichols. And when she goes to the apartment, Nichols opens his billfold, and there's $250s in it. He gives her $150, and apparently Diaz saw the $50. When she leaves, at this point, we have four people in the apartment. We have Shepherd in the apartment, John Shepherd. We have Michael Nichols in the apartment. We have Diaz in the apartment. We have his running mate, Jose Cordova. And the Cordova and Diaz decide to rob and get what, that 50 bucks and whatever else Nichols had, because they were all pretty high. So at that point, Shepherd was pretty leery of him. He didn't care much for Diaz. He was scared of him. And so Shepherd had left the apartment, came back and went to bed and heard this noise, and he woke up and discovered that both Diaz and Cordova were attacking John Michael Nichols. He tried to intervene, and what they end up doing is tying both of them up, putting them on the floor. Both of them get tied up. And at that point, according to the testimony, Jose Cordova pulled up Michael Nichols, and as he pulled him up, Diaz began to stab him. He stabbed him with a kitchen butcher knife, stabbed him something like 94 different times.
The knife broke?
Part of the knife broke off in the man's ribs. And at that point, when they got through with stabbing and beating up Nichols, and they turned their attention to Shepherd, and they stabbed him a couple of times in the face, and he apparently passed out, and they thought he was dead, and they left. And so when Shepherd comes to, of course, he gets up. This is around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. He then calls the police, and the police show up. And at this point, here's the evidence that ties both Cordova and ties Diaz to the murder scene. When the police come there, they find a bloody beer bottle in the apartment next to the body with his fingerprints and DNA on it. Outside in Nichols' pickup, they found a footprint, surprisingly enough, on top of the keypad that gets into the apartment complex. And I'm assuming that Diaz climbed over the fence and put his foot on that keypad that people use. They found his footprint there, and they found some more evidence inside the pickup. There's a lot of blood inside the pickup. Then what else pretty well convicted them, after the killings took place, Diaz and Cordova called one of Cordova's friends to come and pick them up. And he picks them up, and they go to his house, borrow some clothes because their clothes are bloody. And the thing that really hurts in this particular case is that the man that picked him up heard Diaz call one of his friends and heard Diaz describe the entire murder. Oh. So what happened, basically, you have Diaz explaining the murder to somebody on the telephone, and Cordova's friend overhearing it, and of course, he testifies at trial. So what happened at that point, of course, arrest warrant is issued for Diaz, and Diaz's grandmother, who had reared him since he was the age of 5 years old, saw everything on radio and television, and she calls the police and turns her own grandson in, because at that point, he's staying out, hiding out with his sister, and turns him in. That's basically the case, because they had a pretty much of an airtight case. They had the surviving person, John Shepherd, who testified and identified Diaz. They have his DNA and bloody stuff inside the house. They have prints leading him to the pickup that was outside the house. So they had pretty much of an airtight case. And he ends up getting the death penalty out of Hidalgo County.
This Hidalgo County, mm-hmm. And there's not much question about guilt or innocence.
He's never claimed otherwise. What he's done in interviews later on, he basically said that, he said, I was so high and everybody was so drunk that night, I didn't really know what I was doing. He's never at any time ever claimed he didn't do the killing. So there's never been a question about
that. What happened to Cordova?
Pardon me?
What happened to his
He got a life sentence.
Anything interesting at punishment?
Susan's going to cover that pretty well because I've asked her to look at it since.
Okay, what happens at punishment is the state puts on evidence essentially that he was a bad prisoner, that he didn't want to go to court, wouldn't comply with deputies, that he was digging, a hole in his cell at the county jail, presumably to get an escape. And that he had assaultive behavior towards other inmates. What the defense does at punishment is the defense puts on only one witness. And the one witness the defense puts on is a psychologist. The psychologist is hired by the defense to evaluate Diaz. The psychologist's testimony is not helpful to Diaz. The psychologist testifies that Diaz had head trauma, that he had been in a car accident, and that he had been knocked unconscious in several barroom fights. And based on his head trauma, the psychologist felt that this resulted in an inability for Diaz to be able to control himself and an inability to be able to exercise, wise, prudent judgment, and that it may have also contributed to Diaz not being able to, perceive reality the way most other people do. The psychologist says that Diaz was fairly low intelligence and that he also exhibited antisocial behavior starting from childhood. The psychologist did a written report, and the state, when the psychologist testified, the state wanted to introduce the psychologist's written report. The defense objected, and the psychologist's written report came in over the defense objection. The written report really just, elaborated on what the psychologist's opinions were. It was more bad information about Diaz. And really, even without the written report coming in, the state still could have cross-examined the psychologist about his evaluation of Diaz.
So if the defense hires a psychologist, that comes as a package. It comes as the testimony that's answered to the questions on the stand. And there's a written report that is submitted to the defense. And that's evidence that the state can get at? Is that the way that works?
Yes. If you put the defense put the witness on, the defense did not have to have him testify. That was their choice. I mean, obviously the defense team could have had a psychologist evaluate him, could have seen what the evaluation said, and said,
just not calling.
We're not calling him at punishment. The defense, I don't understand why, because there was nothing good was going to come out of this psychological report. There was nothing good was going to come from the psychologist after evaluating Diaz, but they called him as a witness. So the report basically elaborated on, the negative information about Diaz, which the state could have still, just even if the report wasn't admitted as a written report, the state could have cross-examined the psychologist.
You know, Jim, that's not the first time we've run across this.
Now, here's the way it works, right? Here's the problem. He's called as an expert witness.
Yeah.
Whenever he gives a conclusion, A, B, C, the other side's entitled to know the foundation for that conclusion. Therefore, all his underlying data becomes admissible. And what you got to do as a lawyer, if you have any sense, you're going to realize that good things come out and bad things come out. You got to weigh, am I better off? Does the good outweigh the bad? In this particular case, nothing good came out of the psychologist report.
Am I mistaken that, by the way, I've got a producer looking at me. We were supposed to have a guest by the name of Joe Flores, and Joe Flores knows how to listen to this show on his smartphone. And, Joe, if you're not in the courtroom and you don't know the number to call, I want to remind you that KPFT is not, a call-in show. But we're going to try to get Joe up here in a second. The Dwayne Buck case.
Right.
It was the defense that put the objectionable psychologist on the stand.
Exactly. And in this case, what's bizarre, you have a real bad set of facts, and it seems to me that what the lawyers did is put the final nail in the coffin by calling the psychologist, because they basically said, what the psychologist basically said, he's a sociopath and he's going to be a career criminal. And that's the last thing you want to hear.
That's the last thing you want
And it just seems to me these lawyers were terribly inept or naive, or I'm just amazed that they put him on. Everybody's amazed.
Well, is it your impression that this defense lawyer is basically incompetent in regard to this?
I don't really see where any defense lawyer, you would have a psychologist evaluate the defendant, your client. You could even have two psychologists if you wanted to evaluate them. You could have as many as you wanted to pay for. But when you get the evaluation back and it's extremely negative, and I would not put him on at trial. I don't see any reason to put him on at trial. There was nothing helpful. It was all negative.
Is it possible that they didn't have any mitigating evidence that they were comfortable with?
Well, what happened? They could have put on mitigating evidence.
Now we're talking here about punishment.
Right, right. What they could have done, what you normally do in cases like this, you try to paint a picture of somebody with a tragic childhood, and what you basically are saying, this child never had a chance. It's kind of like the little story about Sonny Liston. He died the day he was born.
Okay.
So you put on this real tragic information about somebody's background to try to get the jury to realize that he never had a chance at life. Therefore, perhaps he deserves a chance not to die, but to live. The problem is, according to the writs and everything else, Diaz didn't want his family to testify. So when the lawyers had either talked to the family or otherwise, he didn't want his family to testify. And he was the one that said that. He didn't want them coming forward. So the mitigating evidence was limited to either putting the psychologist on or putting on nobody. And I think it was a terrible mistake to put the psychologist on.
I think we're going to bring in Joe Flores right now. Thank you, Elizabeth, and for giving us some insight. This is not cooking up real well. Joe?
Hey, how are you, Ray, and everybody on the panel? Thank you for having me.
Thank you for standing by to be on the show. Now, you normally practice law in Corpus Christi.
Down to the Rio Grande Valley.
But you travel those beautiful highways all the way down into the valley and put up with the bleak landscape to defend and protect people down there, right?
Yes, to the best of my ability, I try.
Where are you?
Right now we're in Laredo. In fact, I just, with 99% Hispanic attorney, and we had our own little focus group about Diaz a couple of hours this afternoon, and I got their input as well, and we kind of had a roundtable discussion as Hispanic lawyers about whether or not Hispanics are getting an equitable shake as far as the death penalty.
In Hidalgo County and surrounds.
Right.
And let's see, that's Cameron County and Hidalgo County.
Star County. Morelosi County.
Zapata, you name it.
Okay.
Yeah, way down there. That's my neck of the woods.
Okay, so there's a lot of Spanish surname defendants down there?
Oh, yeah, and especially down in Hidalgo County where our guy was. And, so I've been hearing the panel discussion, and I agree with everything that they're saying. But I do think that there is even the case here was a bit more colorblind because it was the Douglas County. Had it been a different county, it would be different. But I say overall, if a Hispanic defendant kills somebody, are they more likely to get the death penalty? I'd have to say, based on the balance of things, yes.
Well, we were discussing before the show that this particular case, and this particular case is unique in that there are no nice, white, innocent people involved here. They're all kind of wrongdoers, that this probably would never have been a capital case in Harris County.
I tend to agree. Yeah, I practiced there with Abraham and Watkins for several years and clerked there and saw a lot of trials, and you're right. I think that Harris County is a different county than, say, Hidalgo and Webb and Starr.
What do you think accounts for that difference? If you were in Hidalgo County and you were in the prosecutor's office, what about this case would catch your attention and say, we're going to invest the kind of money necessary to not only to try this case as a capital case, but pay the expenses of protecting our conviction?
Well, first off would be the egregious facts of the case on Diaz. The 94 times is the thing. If I was the prosecutor and stepped in the shoes, which I'm not, I'm usually a defense attorney, and proud of it. But what I would do is say, when did he first think he killed him? The 14th stab or the 92nd stab or when? And say the egregious factors and also stabbing the witness twice in the face. The crimes that he had done beforehand, the month before, would sort of lead up to this guy as somebody we will invest in to have a state-sanctioned killing of him. And that's, I'm jumping in the shoes of a prosecutor. For the record, I'm not.
Yeah, I understand. It's my fault. I lead people down these garden paths and let them survive or not on their own. You understand? That's the nature of this
program.
Love
it, Rick.
Joe, last week we did the Robert Garza case.
Right.
It was another capital case. Robert Garza was 19 when that happened. He thought he was invincible. He was caught up in an outlaw drug culture. Nothing he did was inconsistent with the culture that he lived in. Also last week, we interviewed Robert Garza on this show, and we found a very different person. We found a person who had spent 11 years on death row, and he's now 30, and he is responsible to his family. He cares about his children and his wife. And the person that they killed was very different from the person that committed the crime. And in the case of Arturo Diaz, Arturo was 24, which is close enough to being 19. Is there, in your practice, invincibility assurance of younger defendants?
Well, first of all, I believe firmly, and studies will back that up. I'm a nurse practitioner and a lawyer, and I've read a lot of medical stuff. You are not the same man when you're 35. If you're 18 to 25, you're just still, in many ways, still a child and still have that feeling of invincibility. And I think in our culture, the Hispanic culture, especially in the lower socioeconomic rung, you're looking at an external locus of control. As God wills, it's in the hands of God. It's not in my deal. What happens, happens. And we see that that's endemic in the culture. And that mixed with the other, and drugs, and also not, the factors that, say, Diaz had, the abusive childhood, the mutilation, everything that went on, made a perfect storm, the seventh grade education. For the pro-capital of audience out there listening, I'm sure they are, my heart goes out to the victims and everything, but the point here being is that how did this man come to be where he is? And I think the age factor just has everything to do with it. You've got an 18 to 25 year old. I wish we could all, redo 18 to 25, but, this guy's background just led him to do this vicious crime. He himself admitted to KRGV that, yeah, I did it. I don't know if I deserve to be killed for it.
Joe Flores, one final question. Obviously, culpable mental state, as affected by age and maturity, is something that might, if addressed by the legal profession and the political system, be reformable. What do you think?
I mean, there's no question that, you know, they're doing that for veterans, Ray, and the distinguished panel knows that, that for veterans, you're getting a redo on DWIs, you're getting a redo on a lot of things, and they're saying that you've gone through so much post-traumatic stress that, you know, except for the most egregious offenses, we need to really rethink what we're doing with our youth. If it's somebody that was 35 or 40 that did this, but say a lesser crime, I think that that is a great way to go. It has to be at least one factor in determining this. And by the way, I hear they're running out of serum by the end of the month.
Actually, I saw an article that this may be the last execution for a while because of the serum issue.
My understanding is yes. And I just think that there is no really, kind of deal that indicates that, you know, I just have to firmly believe, and what I've read is that minorities and blacks and Hispanics are incarcerated at higher levels than others, and there's nothing to, really disagree that but if you look at executionwatch.org, there are whites, blacks, and Hispanics on there.
Yep.
And that's what I got from our focus group that I held this afternoon prior to the interview. I talked with 9 defense attorney Hispanics from the border, and they all indicated, well, I think he got a fair shot. Hispanic jury, Hispanic judge, who even got after the defense attorney and rebuked him with a 602-page rebuke. He exhausted his remedies, but the only flaw we see is arguably that Alexander, the attorney early on, even though with a bar complaint that was eventually dropped, that the Fifth Circuit had their hands tied. Had this been in Illinois, it might have been a different story, been life without parole, which you and I, Ray, know. That's a death sentence, too.
Right. Okay, Joe Flores, how do people find you? Tell them about the YouTube location of your previous television shows.
Just South Texas Crossfire. We've been on 9 seasons. You were my inspiration, Ray, with Prison Talk. We went ahead and put that on, and it has been wonderful. The Lopez family down here, we basically have a Hispanic-controlled television and radio outlet, which can be dangerous, ladies and gentlemen. And we thank you for everything you've done, and the panel here, you guys have been great. I've heard all the comments and everything, and we got some stellar lawyers up there, and so you can reach me at FlautusLawFirm.com, and you can also like or hate me on Flautus Law Firm on Facebook. But I want to say, and all the Hispanic lawyers down here said, our deepest sympathies to the family and the victim. But, you know, this is a different and separate and distinct issue of capital punishment. And so anyway, thanks, guys.
Thank you, Joe
me.
Flores, and I appreciate your being on Execution Watch.
God bless you guys, and God bless your audience. Bye-bye.
And that was Joe Flores. He is down in Laredo, Texas, talking to other Hispanic lawyers about doing criminal defense work. Well, Mike, what you got?
Well, I've been asked to look into the writ procedure.
Pull the microphone down a little bit.
And what happens in these death penalty cases, what happens in criminal cases, is that you have a trial lawyer that tries the case. After the trial lawyer tries the case, there can be a writ lawyer, and what the writ lawyer basically does is goes over the trial lawyer's work to make sure there's no errors. The writ lawyer is very important in the state of Texas because the writ lawyer documents any error the trial lawyer made. Why this is so critical is that if the trial lawyer makes a mistake, the writ lawyer can point it out to the appellate court to reverse it. But if the writ lawyer makes a mistake, the next level is federal court, and only what he put in paper goes to federal court. So if he misses something, there's nobody to pick it up. And that's what happened in this case.
Wait a minute. It seemed just a few weeks ago we were doing another case where both the trial lawyer and the writ lawyer was the same lawyer.
there are some times that that does happen, but as we talked last time, that is not an obtuse situation because sometimes a man cannot see his own mistakes. In this case, there was another lawyer. The problem with this other lawyer is that according to himself, he had only done this once before. And what he did is he made 19 complaints in 35 pages. When the writ is 19 complaints and 35 pages, by definition, it's too brief, it's too shotgun, and it doesn't give specific facts to give the appellate courts the option to reverse things. When the writ lawyer says that the trial lawyer didn't call in witnesses and didn't bring in a tape, he didn't specify what witnesses he would have called or what they would have said. The appellate court cannot guess. The writ lawyer actually said he did it on purpose to have an open gun, an open approach, so he could put in facts later that meant the shotgun. It doesn't make any sense. The main reason it doesn't make any sense is that he had two or three really strong avenues of writ. And those areas, the one that was never brought up, is the fact that one of the complaints in the federal court is that it seems like in plea bargaining before trial, the state offered life instead of death.
Mike, just a second. We have a report from Huntsville. Yes, Gloria, you're on.
Oh, Ray?
Yes.
Oh, it's over. The family has just come out of the death house. And Texas has another notch on their belt. 505 people.
During the interview with our guest, it was pointed out that we may run into a shortage of serum.
Well, actually, I think that what that was used tonight may not have been part of their supply of pentobarbital because they're refusing to say where it came from. So I'm assuming it came from a compounding pharmacy, but apparently Justin Clark has no comment. So,
do you know if that angle was addressed in the appellate?
If what?
If that angle was addressed in appellate?
I'm not sure. Where is Joy?
Not really the appellate opinion that came out yesterday.
Yeah, we've got...
the issue of the drugs addressed in the appeal?
I have downloaded it, but honestly, I have not even...
We're not sure, right?
Okay, well, Jim has read it. So give our sympathy to the family, and I want to go to explain to the audience what happens now.
Okay, and I want to tell the men on the row that we... our sympathy to all of y'all who were friends with Arturo.
Thank you, Gloria.
Okay.
That was Gloria Ruback, who had the sad duty of reporting that this process is over. What happens now is Stearns Funeral Services will, Carnes, C-A-R-N-E-S, will go in and get the body and take it to a nearby chapel where the Diaz family will gather around and there will be the body covered by a sheet on a gurney, and they'll be able to touch the body while it is still warm. They do that in death cases where there is family, because the family has been denied the ability to touch Arturo Diaz for the whole time he is on death row. I know that sounds morbid, but if you could still touch someone you love while they were still warm or not, I think you would have to consider that alternative. This is Ray Hill for Execution Watch announcing officially that Arturo Diaz is dead. A homicide at the hands of Texas. Now, Mike, let's get back to where you were.
Well, where we were was at that point. It seems like before trial, the state made an offer to him for life in prison. Now, the facts of the case are such that we do not feel it could have been won. So therefore, the only options is life in prison or death. The claim that he did not understand the options makes sense to me because why would you not take life? Especially when in the later briefs, he complains about the lawyer not calling his family members, saying, if my family members were allowed to testify, I might have gotten life. That might be something he thought of later. But at the same time, it's something the lawyer should have made up to him, made clear to him. And I think what really happened on this case, and I'm just thinking of this, but I got a feeling the lawyer did give him the option to life. But I got a feeling what the lawyer did not do is explain that life at that time meant he could have been paroled out at some time. I think when you're faced with life in prison or death, you can roll the dice because you don't want life in prison. But it was explained to you that life in prison might mean parole to
and
be
the
out
laws, and the laws then
allowed that, it seems like.
Would have allowed him to be parole considered.
And that, to me, is a critical area that should have been brought up on appeal. And it wasn't. The lawyer actually said, I made up things to be general in case we found facts later on that could fit. Well, then I had pled it.
Oh, my God.
When you have something as strong as not explaining the consequence, let's talk about what you do as an attorney. If you're an attorney, your job is to be strong. And sometimes you have to teach a client how serious it is. And what I normally find, what teaches a client is serious, is a threat to withdraw. Telling the client that if you want to do this, get another lawyer because I don't want you on my conscience here.
That's a mechanism that a lawyer can do.
And then you write it out in black and white and hand it to him.
And say, sign this.
And it sinks in. And maybe that is what a lawyer needs to do. And my God, if you can't convince your client, how are you supposed to convince a jury? Our job is to convince people. Our client needs to be the first ones we convince to do what he needs to do. It seems like that this man is only deceased today because he didn't take the plea bargain. And I find that to be shocking. And I also find that the fact that...
Now, so between you and Elizabeth, we have a couple of incompetent attorneys. Is that fair? Elizabeth, is that fair?
I'm Susan.
Susan, is that fair?
Well, I think it may, perhaps the psychologist said that being hit over the head or all his head traumas, that it might have affected his ability to make proper judgments and his perception of reality. And you really do have to kind of, if the best he could do at trial was life, that would be the best possible he could do. The worst he could do was death. They were offering life. At that time.
Life with the possibility of parole,
right,
which wouldn't be offered now.
That's
now,
that
if you've
correct.
Got a capital case and you're going to trial, you either die now or die later.
So, you know, perhaps his, shall we say, his thinking was not correct, although it would seem likely his lawyers probably begged him to take the life sentence.
Ray, and answer your question, the federal writ lawyer who did the federal writs said that he had two incompetent lawyers. Number one, the incompetent lawyer at trial. He said his writ lawyer was incompetent.
Who's covering the feds?
Guy by the name of Wright.
No, who's doing it here?
Oh, the same guy Wright's doing it here. But here, and tell you what, it's so bad. It's not just me saying this. This lawyer was so bad at the writ lawyer level that what happened, there was a committee from the National from Texas Defenders Program that was reviewing a bunch of writs because it had a lot of complaints about writ lawyers being bad. They filed a grievance on this guy. Yes, they filed a grievance on him
because of this case.
Because he's incompetent. Because not only he had wrong facts in the writ. In fact, it was so bad that the trial judge wrote a 606-page opinion blasting him. And they filed, and it was so bad that a committee that studies death penalty cases said this guy's incompetent, has no business doing writs. And they filed a grievance on it, and the state bar, of course, dismissed the grievance. And here's what's even crazier. Back then, to do a state writ, you had to be approved by the Court of Criminal Appeals. They had approved 136 lawyers to be on that group to do writs.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of those 136. This was the second writ he'd ever done.
And he was on the list.
Even after all this publicity came out that they filed a grievance on him for being incompetent, he remained on the list. It's incredible. I mean, and so it's not just me saying this. It's not the federal lawyer saying that the guy was incompetent. We had a group of lawyers that were so outraged about what he'd done in the writ that they themselves filed a grievance with the state bar. So it's just not Mike saying that. It's just not Susan saying that and me saying that or his federal lawyer saying that. We're talking about a whole group of lawyers and citizens filed a complaint.
And, Jim, the part about this that I don't understand is that we've been here many weeks and we see cases reversed for little tic-tac errors. Yet this is major, and there is no remedy for it because the writ lawyer...
Let me tell you why there's no remedy. You got to read Strickland verse, and Jack is going to cover that.
Okay, let's...
The reason there's no good remedy for that, we got a real problem with a case called Strickland versus Washington. That is the problem. And the next problem was, guess who was the judge who issued the opinion that came out yesterday? Edith Jones.
Oh!
Does that tell you something,
oh,
right?
Okay. Does that tell you something?
Judge, Jim, there is a time that just needs to be a do-over.
Now, I understand. I'm not arguing. I'm talking about the law. I understand that. But the problem is the case of Strickland. I've asked Jack to discuss that because with these egregious facts, Jack will explain why under
Jack,
the law.
Talk about your friend Strickland.
All right. Well, Strickland v. Washington, it's when there's a complaint on an attorney being incompetent and ineffective counsel. Well, in order to, Strickland v. Washington came up with a two-prong test. There are two things that the appellant has to show. First of all, you have to show that the counsel provided inadequate service. That the counsel was ineffective. And it's not just that not being perfect is not good enough. You don't even have to be good. You have to be truly incompetent. You really have to be ineffective to meet that standard. And the burden is on the appellant. If you're appealing, the defendant has to demonstrate that his attorney was incompetent. And let me tell you, you have to be asleep behind the wheel and hit a tree in order to be incompetent.
It's kind of like you have to prove that the cat was not in the room at the time.
Let me tell you the reason for that. The reason for that, I'm not justifying the good, but I'm talking about what the courts say. The courts say that anything that can be trial strategy, although we disagree with it, if it's trial strategy, we're going to give her benefit of the doubt to the lawyer. Good example. Mike McCormick, who was the head of the Court of Criminal Appeals a number of years ago, when Joe Cannon was sleeping during the better part of a capital murder case, it was so bad that one of the jurors told the judge, wake up the defense lawyer. And they went up on the writ on that case. And you know what McCormick wrote in majority opinion? That was trial strategy, because he was trying to get sympathy from the jury by sleeping. And so what they do when they look at this, they give the benefit of the doubt to the lawyer and say it's trial strategy. And you're exactly right. We had a lawyer sleeping through a capital murder case, and they said that's trial strategy. And they said they'd meet that first prong of Strickland. It's crazy, but that's
Joe
what they said.
Joe could snore pretty loudly.
He might knock his wig off, but yeah. But anyway, that's the reason, that because the courts give every presumption in the world to a lawyer and say whatever they do, they'll dream it up as some sort of trial strategy. But go ahead, Jack.
Now, let's suppose you actually demonstrate that the attorney is incompetent and that his services were ineffective. The second prong of the Strickland test is even more difficult to overcome. It's the but-for test. Effectively, what the but-for is, you have to demonstrate that but for the ineffectiveness of your attorney, that the result would have been different. You have to show...
Wait a minute. You have to show that but for the incompetence of the lawyer... This guy could have walked out of the courtroom?
Oh, yeah.
Or have a lesser
or
sentence.
Or have a lesser charge. Right. And so, effectively, what this... And all of this is pure speculation. But you have to bring so much evidence to demonstrate that even though you're speculating, that there is no possible way that if your attorney had been competent, that your attorney had, or rather not competent, if your attorney had not been ineffective, that you could have gotten the certain result. And in this case, the result would have been having the death penalty. It's pure speculation, and it's so difficult to overcome.
Supreme Court is a Supreme Court case, exactly. It's that, like I say, it's a two-prong test. That number one, you got to prove that the lawyer was negligent. It wasn't trial strategy, number one. Mm-hmm. Then you got to prove, but for the negligence, the result would have been different, meaning different verdict or lesser sentence. And what they do is exactly what Edith Jones in this case said. Take all these facts into consideration. I don't care if every lawyer in the world would have defended him. The facts are so horrible and egregious with 94 stab wounds. I don't care what you would have done. They're still going to give him the death penalty. I don't care how good your lawyer is. Yeah. Therefore, they say under Strickland, he didn't meet the Strickland test, that because regardless of what they would have done or not have done, they're going to give him the death penalty because the facts are so horrible.
And the chemical makeup of the execution drugs is just not significant.
Yeah, it was never brought up in the opinion.
Okay.
Once he turned down the plea bargain offer, he was offered life with a chance of parole. That was the big mistake. He turned down that plea bargain offer. That was the best he could possibly get at a trial, and that's what the state was offering.
Yeah, well, later he was struggling to get that result.
Right. Well,
yeah, when Jack and I were talking about it outside, you can't see this case as a continuum. It's a series of snapshots.
Mm-hmm.
Play the ball from where it lays, and if it lays in a different place, because he was complaining that his lawyers did not give him an opportunity. Or did not explain the plea bargain, and then later on he was trying to struggle for what the plea bargain would have resulted in.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Sure, and as applied, when we apply the Strickland test to our case, well, first of all, there was no factual issue. Was there a confession, there were multiple witnesses, and all the circumstantial evidence matched. It looked like issue of innocence or guilt. The only possible issue here could have been mitigation. Why the trial attorneys did not bring up
evidence, but it
wasn't helpful.
Blowing up in their face.
Exactly.
Right.
And one thing I'm always a big believer in, we've had a horrible system of writs here, and we've now changed it. Because thank God we've got some things made different. What I've asked Larry to do is explain the old system where they use writ lawyers and how we're trying to improve it, because at least it's going to be better in the future.
Okay, there is some good news. Unfortunately, it does not help Mr. Diaz. But the old system that Jim has talked about already, about the shortfalls in the old system, is that the Court of Criminal Appeals were appointing the lawyers, making out a list of lawyers who were qualified, supposedly competent to handle writs. But unfortunately, there was no oversight. And so the group that Jim talked about looked at some of the glaring errors that had been made in writ after writ after. They looked at 251 of 263 and found that 40% of them were fatally flawed.
Mm.
So much so that there was one habeas case where the habeas attorney failed to show that the main witness against the defendant had actually recanted, changed his story completely. And once that was pointed out, then the person's case actually got reversed. That person was named Anthony Charles Graves.
Anthony
you know.
Graves, friend of the program.
And don't forget, we had that one writ lawyer file a two-page writ.
normally, at least 100 pages. What the writ lawyer is supposed to, you've got the trial lawyer, you've got the appellate lawyer, and then the writ lawyer is supposed to do an investigation, find out generally everything that happened, and try to find out did anything happen wrong. Particularly things like jury misconduct, those kinds of things. Ineffective assistance of counsel, and apparently these lawyers weren't doing a particularly good job, or they weren't being given the kind of oversight necessary. So what happened is Texas has a new system where there's, since 2010, September 1, 2010, of an Office of Capital Writs, and it's staffed by clearly competent and lawyers who are being overseen by a very competent person. So that there's a decent budget, $1 million, annual budget, a small team of lawyers. We've got 7 writ lawyers and 3 investigators. And
who do they work for?
It is the Office of Capital Writs. Okay, and so
it's the like person, a public defender, right? It's paid for by the state.
It's paid for by the state,
right?
And they work for their defendants,
exactly,
right?
And they're paid for by the state. Okay,
it's paid for by the state, and you've got an overseer, the head of the office. Okay, is a former deputy federal public defender out of Los Angeles, and so what they are now doing is a much better job, we believe, because at least there's some oversight, and the Office of Capital Writs then focuses on the 12 or so writs, capital writs that are handled in Texas on an annual basis, and that's a better way of doing it. It probably will result in better quality work. How much the results are going to be different, we don't know.
Time will tell.
But at least it's better. Because I looked at the web page when we started working up this case. I pulled the web page and looked at all the qualifications of the lawyers. And they have a real active intern program with kids from the Ivy League that are working on it. They've got a lot of brain power that they have resources that the Office of Capital Writs had that the appointed lawyers didn't have.
And that's so important for lawyers to be properly trained, because this lawyer who handled this writ, it being his second writ, if he'd had some oversight, he might would have likely done a much better job. But
if somebody that had been in his office knew what was happening.
Exactly. And that's the institution is going to be a lot better than the individual, I believe, in this case.
Well, Uncle Ray is going to take a little time of his own this time. I want to say hello to the guys down on the row. I've interviewed several people down there recently, including Lurch. Hello, Lurch. This is Ray Hill. You listened to tonight's show as you listened to all of them. And I, by the way, I produced your interview, and it will not be edited. It will be played if we have to do it, and we hope we don't. We're more reluctant to reach that point than I think Lurch is. We've been doing this show now for a long time. If you haven't heard all of our shows, you can. Everything we have done, unless we had a major technical problem that we could not have anticipated, is located on our webpage. The televised program, including the televised interview with Robert Garza, was submitted to the programmer over at Houston Media Source this afternoon. If you will watch our Facebook page and our webpage, we will make announcements when you can watch it as it is broadcast. HMS is also a friend of mine. I'm over there. I'm on the board, and we will soon have a searchable archive where you can download as a podcast all of the programming done over there. So Execution Watch is not just tonight. Execution Watch is in audio form already available throughout its history, and soon when we interview inmates in prison, in death row, visit room, those programs will be available on the video at your leisure and at your convenience. We do this show not because we love doing it. We do this show because we have a responsibility to do it. My name is Ray Hill. I am the host. Our producer is Elizabeth Stein, who works very hard to make sure that we all stay. Our technical director is Otis McClay. And tonight we have young Luke, who is with KPFT Evening News. And he covers, you can hear him almost daily on KPFT at 4 o'clock. Our guest was Joe Flores. Thank you, Joe, from down in the valley. Arturo Diaz is dead. Jim Skelton and Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, and Jack Lee helped us understand what reality is. I want to thank Gloria Ruback from the abolitionmovement.org and Dave Atwood of the Texas Coalition to End the Death Penalty. The music is by Victoria Panetti, whose brother is on death row. Thank you for listening. Good night.
If you care about what you just heard, please go to kpft.org and support Execution Watch and KPFT by making a donation. The support that makes shows like this possible comes from listeners like you. Thanks for listening.